Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the daunting task ahead for the Democrats, who hope to take back the House and even the Senate in 2018, and speak with George Lakoff, Professor Emeritus of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of The All-New Don't Think of an Elephant and The Political Mind. He joins us to discuss the recent Democratic defeat in the most expensive congressional race in history and offer an alternative strategy for Democrats as they try to reach out to disaffected Republican voters in potential swing districts. Facing a gerrymandered electorate with unlimited Republican money pouring in, Lakoff argues that the Democrats are doomed as long as they fail to learn from recent defeats while clinging to the vain hope Trump will self-destruct or be impeached. He urges them to stop running the same campaigns with bland candidates who continue to run on facts and figures, platforms and policies, while ignoring the political mind and the importance of values and emotions. Then we'll examine the consequences of having a commander-in-chief who delegates decisions to the military as the war against ISIS in Syria and Iraq gets more complicated and potentially explosive, while the security situation in Afghanistan deteriorates. Henri Barkey, the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, who was a member of the State Department's policy planning staff on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, joins us to discuss that in the absence of hands-on leadership, there is a growing possibility that a clash between the U.S. and Syrian or Iranian forces could spark a wider war in Syria. Then finally, we will speak with Mel Goodman, an expert on U.S. relations with Russia, who served as a senior analyst and division chief at the CIA and is the author of 6 books on U.S. intelligence and international security, the latest of which is Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account of the politics of intelligence. He joins us to discuss the inner workings of the intelligence community and how corruption, intimidation, and misinformation can lead to disastrous foreign interventions. And joining us now is George Lakoff, a professor emeritus of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, co-written with Elizabeth Verling. And his latest book is The All-New Don't Think of an Elephant. Welcome to Background Briefing, George Lakoff.
Always glad to be on.
Well, thank you, George. And what did you make of the election that took place last week in Georgia? Record amount of money spent. That's an obscenity all on its own, I guess. But in terms of the work that you do in trying to get the Democrats to frame their arguments better and to literally come up with better campaigns, clearly this would have been a major blow to President Trump and the Republicans had Ossoff won. It might well have affected this controversial health care bill that they put out last week. And in general, why did they seem to go back to Hillary Clinton's playbook? This guy was a documentary filmmaker. His campaign was basically, we should all be nice to each other. And he talked about getting rid of government waste. I just felt like somebody in that Ossoff campaign should have been listening to George Lakoff.
I wish they had. It was horrifying to me to see it. And he had no idea about he didn't even know what a conservative was. He had no idea about strict father morality and how it worked and how to talk to people who have that and who care about people in their in-groups, who are their people, not other people. And there are ways of doing that. He didn't come across forcefully at all for anything. You have to come across any community like that as someone who has powerful ideas and speaks powerfully. And he was doing exactly the opposite. He was being a wimp. Every time I watched them on TV, I just said, oh, my God, And then Karen Handel sort of handed him the show. She came out saying, I do not believe in a living wage. Do you know what he could have done with that?
I know.
He could have gone out to every working person. In every diner, everybody on the street who is doing any kind of job, every construction worker, saying, Do you have a living wage? Do you think you should? You know, Karen Handel says she doesn't believe in a living wage, and I think that a living wage is central to your freedom and our democracy. If he had come out and said stuff like that and talked about why it was central to freedom, you know, he'd have won.
Why did they not, though? You know, so Bernie Sanders, they haven't learned anything from him. First of all, Fox did a poll that finds Bernie Sanders is the most popular politician in America. He has followings amongst the very same people who vote for Donald Trump. And his argument about the economy, instead of Ossoff's argument, which is a rehash of centrist economics, the middle class appeals, all that stuff we've heard forever, Bernie Sanders has made it clear, as he says, that the economy is rigged. And this resonates on the left and the right. And when he's handed a gift, like she's saying that she doesn't believe in a living wage, my God. So what's going on here? This feels like the Democrats are a zombie party.
The Democrats don't understand even their own worldview, even their own moral worldview, and they don't know how to frame anything or communicate anything. You know, I've been trying to work with them for years and years, and you get, you know, they don't read. Republicans read more than Democrats. I don't know if you knew this.
Right. Well, maybe the operatives do, and the politicians, their followers don't. That's
The operatives don't read. This is the thing I found. I found all over the place. They don't read. They're busy being operatives. They don't understand things. They don't think things through. You know, they think everything is about materialism, and that not only is about materialism, it's about materialism in the campaign. You know, so they're worried about getting out the vote, but they're not worried about getting people to understand why they should vote. And they're still thinking in terms of 1650 reasoning. That is, that thought is logic. If you, and that everybody has the same thought, if you just tell people the facts, they will reason to the right conclusion. It doesn't happen. They have to be told morally, why they should. Why morally? Because your sense of right and wrong is who you are. You want to think that you're doing right at all, as much as you can, and that's who you are as a person, right? So your moral views, your view of what's right and wrong, is who you are, and therefore you want to hear not stuff about policy and programs and so on. You want to hear why what is being proposed is right,
and again,
nothing said.
Right. And again, I'm speaking with George Lakoff, a professor emeritus of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of the Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, co-written with Elizabeth Welling, and his latest book is The All-New Don't Think of an Elephant. But to be fair, I suppose, or to give the Democrats some benefit of the doubt here, it is a problem because the Republicans have gerrymandered so successfully. And in fact, the Republicans really rely on undemocratic principles. They've rigged the system through Citizens United, flooded it with money. They've gotten rid of an important part of the Voting Rights Act. They've gerrymandered an extraordinary extent. And in Trump's case, they've got this Electoral College, which itself is undemocratic. So in many ways, you could make the case that the Republicans rely on undemocratic methods to get elected. And this leaves the Democrats with some very narrow choices to win back the House, because they're trying to win over these red states and turn them purple. And that was what was going on, notwithstanding what an appalling campaign Ossoff ran. But this is the inherent challenge for the Democrats, surely. In these districts, the candidates they field feel like they have to reach out to the center to win over disaffected Republicans, but at the same time, in doing so, they alienate their Democratic base. So, if that's...
there is no center.
I see.
And they don't understand that there is no center.
So what would your advice be in this, not to even think of it as a dilemma?
This is very basic. What is a moderate? A moderate conservative is someone who has some progressive ideas about some things or other. Okay? A moderate progressive is someone who has some conservative views on some things or other. But there isn't any ideology of the moderate. There's no set of things that all moderates believe. Moderates are defined relative to extremes. And so the result is that there is no center. So what that, you know, what you have to do is understand that there are conservatives who are partly progressive. You talk to them as if they were progressive because if they respond to progressive language, that will make their progressive views stronger in their brains. They don't think about brains. They don't think that language that fits your brain is going to make that part of those circuits in your brain stronger. They don't. It's very basic neuroscience. They don't get it.
So what then can they do to overcome the obstacles that I say are there systemically, in the sense that the Republicans, in effect, rely on undemocratic methods, whether it's through the Supreme Court or through the antiquated Electoral College or through their skillful gerrymandering that began in 2010 with the census?
The first thing to understand is that this cannot be fixed by next week. There has to be a long-term effort at changing public discourse. That's why I've started this citizens communication network for that reason. You know, the idea is changing public discourse with lots and lots of people over a long period of time. You know, having them understand what is going on better, and having them understand what they believe and why they believe it, and then being able to express it. And, you know, this has to be done day after day after day after day for a long period of time. That's part one. The second thing is that in a red state, there are ways to talk to people who are arch conservatives. You know, they may not believe in, not agree with your politics at all. However, there's something important to understand about people who are very, very conservative in their politics. They have what I'll call in-group nurturance or care. They care about people in their church. They'll do things for people who are having a hard time in their church. They'll work with them. They care about people in their military unit. They care about their neighbors, the people they play softball with, the people in their community. They actually, if you are one of their people, they will care about you, and they'll do things for you. And if there's a fire, they'll be out manning the fire hoses. I mean, this is important to understand about conservatives. It's not that they're all bad people. When it comes to their people, the people they care about, they're very good people. They act like decent, fine, upstanding, terrific, caring citizens. Now, in those actions, they're actions about everyday life. So it's important to talk about everyday life, not about the government and government programs and government policies.
Well, the other structural problem, though, George Lakoff, is that there's a demographic shift that's been going on for decades, where from the rural red states, there's a migration to the cities, and usually these are talented people that want to go to a more cosmopolitan environment, and they tend to be more educated, etc. So what you're ending up with now is our cities are all filled with Democratic voters who are educated, and the rest of the country is being sort of depopulated by these people, and you end up with a less educated mass. And as Donald Trump said, I love the poorly educated. So that strikes me as a fundamental problem.
Well, first of all, it's wrong to think of conservatives as uneducated. It's just absolutely false. I mean, that's a big mistake Hillary Clinton made with saying, you know, we're going to get the educated, college-educated women in the suburbs of Philadelphia or something like that, when they voted Republican, they voted for Trump, right? And the point is that, you know, if you have strict father morality, you can be smart, and you can be well-educated. And, you know, and they'll probably read more than the Democrats will. It, you know, it isn't the case that education determines all of these things. There are plenty of uneducated Democrats.
But what about the structural problem with the way you've got gerrymandering and the Electoral College? It's just, in general, we have this phenomenon going on. It's a demographic phenomenon, isn't it, where the red states are being depopulated, yet they have disproportionate political power, and more people are being concentrated in the cities, which dilutes their political power.
Well, first of all, gerrymandering is something that has been worked on. You know, I know that I'm very familiar and have been involved in that history. The conservatives came out with these ideas in the late 90s publicly. And what they wanted to do was take over state legislatures because it costs less money to get a state legislator elected than to get a congressperson elected. And so what they did was put their money into getting state legislators who did the redistricting elected, and then they did the redistricting. This was not a secret. It was out there. The Democrats knew all about it and did nothing to stop it. I wrote about it and thought about it and lectured on it then. Democrats did nothing.
So again, it's really about the zombie party then, right? They just aren't dealing with reality. I mean, it's, what is it going to take? I know Bernie Sanders
the problem is deeper than that. It's not education versus non-education. It's the kind of education. If you are a conservative and you're going to college, what are you going to study? You're going to get an education. What are you going to study? You're going to take some business courses, most likely. And in those courses, you're going to take a course called marketing. And the marketing professors study my field, cognitive science. They study how people really think. They think in terms of frames and metaphors and narratives and emotions and images. So that becomes natural. They learn to market their ideas. Okay? If you're a progressive and you go to college, you're interested in politics, what do you study? You study political science, law, public policy, economic theory. Right? Now, what is taught about reasoning in those courses? They are taught reasoning from 1650 and Descartes. They're taught that reasoning is logic, that all thought is conscious when it's 98% unconscious. They're taught that everybody has the same reason because we're all human beings, so that notion of reason defines what a human being is. And therefore, if you just tell people the facts, they should reason to the right conclusion, especially if they're educated. It never works. It keeps not working. They keep telling people fact after fact after fact. It keeps not working. Why? Because people vote their identity, who they are morally. Their sense of what's right and wrong defines who you are. Very important. The sense of right and wrong defines who you are, because you always want to think of yourself as doing right, or at least intending to do right. Right? Now, if you have a conservative view of right and wrong, you're going to go one way. If you have a progressive view, you're going to go a different way, with different notions of right and wrong. And that's important to understand. You have to talk to people where their identity is with their moral system. So you can't just tell them about, just one bill, one kind of bill or one issue. People ask you, what's your most important issue? Wrong question. The issue is always, what's right? You know, whenever you talk about any issue, the question is, what is right and how does it connect with all the other issues? What are the most right things you could be doing? They don't talk about why these things are right. They just assume that everybody knows why they're right, and they talk about, you know, the statistics. So and so many people will lose their health care with this, so and so many people will have their premiums raised, and so on. They'll give you more numbers, more facts, and so on.
But how do you make the case then, if it's not, it's a case about being right, how about being fair? In other words, is there a case you can make that the system is rigged for the rich, it's not fair, the opportunities, the whole Al-Jahis mythology, the American dream, is at stake here. The system is rigged, as I mentioned before, which is
as you do that and you talk to people who have strict father morality, whether they're rich or poor, they think that the rich are better than the poor, that people are poor because they're lazy and deserve to be poor.
Right, and that's why they hate the Democrats, because they feel they give stuff away to the poor and don't give a damn about them, right?
Exactly.
But let's try and turn this around. How can you make an argument that's going to resonate with these people?
Notice the question you ask, make an argument.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking Cartesian logic.
Right.
You're not talking morality.
I see. So this is about demonstrating as opposed to enunciating.
Well, more than it's demonstrating, but it's also understanding, you know, that people have different moral senses and different senses of identity, and understanding how those work. You know, the Democrats, you know, because they are still thinking in, you know, like it's 1650, don't get it. And they were learned, and they don't get it because they were educated. You know, my own institution, I retired from teaching last year after teaching for 50 years. I taught for 50 years, 44 at Berkeley and, you know, some at Harvard and the University of Michigan before that. You know, and, you know, the problem is in the universities that train all these folks. You know, they train them to think in 1650 terms.
Like the book of John, right? You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. That's
the idea. The truth will set you free.
Right.
Sorry, the truth, unframed, will not set you free. Will not set you free. The truth that is not morally framed will not set you free.
Well, give us a sense then. We started out the conversation where you were tearing your hair out watching the race last week in Georgia, and they certainly weren't listening to you. They haven't been listening to you, and they should listen to you. I'm talking about the Democrats and the Democratic Party and the DNC. What is your final message to them in the hope that they'll get smart?
Well, it's not a single thing. They have to understand how people think. They have to understand what conservatives are, what their own moral system is unconsciously. They have to know how framing works, how messaging works, how brains work. They have to learn something. They have to learn something about the cognitive and brain sciences. I mean, look, what's interesting about this is that most Democrats, you know, complain about science denial when global warming is at stake. But they don't claim about science denial when cognitive and brain science is at stake. When this is about the science of their own minds, they're science deniers.
But you pulled me over earlier for talking about the people in the red states being less educated. What is then the way forward in terms of science denial? You know, there's a place in Kentucky where they have a museum for creationism. And I believe something like 40% of Americans don't believe in evolution.
And how many people, you know, believe that most thought is unconscious?
Right. But if you believe that, you're still stuck with the problem.
People believe that there's no color in the world.
Right.
That color is created by your body and brain, by your color cones in your eyes and your neural circuitry. I mean, look, you know, the most basic things that are taught in a neuroscience class are not taught, not known by most Democrats, Not that they're known by Republicans. But the point is that this is not part of our educational system.
Well, I thank you for joining us. Is there a primer that people can get to understand the case that you're making, that the deficit being not understanding the brain, let alone trying to figure out how to communicate to people who don't believe in evolution?
I wrote a book called The Political Mind a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I'm finishing a book now on the neural mind, on how you get ideas out of neural circuitry and what that means and how it works. But the point is that this is not well known in political circles.
Well, George Lakoff, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate your time.
Ian, it's always a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with George Lakoff, who's a professor emeritus of cognitive science and linguistics at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of The Little Blue Book, The Essential Guide to Thinking and Talking Democratic, co-written with Elizabeth Whaling. And his latest book is the all-new Don't Think of an Elephant. And the book that we all need to read is George Lakoff's The Political Mind. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the consequences of having a commander-in-chief who delegates decisions to the military. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served as a member of the United States Department of State's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored and co-authored and edited five books, among them Turkish Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And as somebody that's been involved in U.S. foreign policy, do you detect a kind of deficit in leadership in terms of a kind of absentee landlord, if you will, the president of the United States being AWOL? He doesn't seem to be able to come up with any policies, plans for Afghanistan. He's delegated it all. And Syria, which there seems to be a looming crisis now in Syria, he seems to be completely absent. And now you've got infighting going on the National Security Council. People, some of these hawks like Cohen Watnick and Harvey going behind Madison McMaster's back. So do you detect a lack of leadership in the United States?
Well, first of all, let me just start by saying that I don't know about the infighting at the White House. I mean, there are rumors, and I think it would be inappropriate for me to comment because I have no knowledge, and these are rumors, and you cannot, you know, there's no way of ascertaining whether they're correct or not. The wider question is that whether or not there is leadership. The truth is, Trump has notions. And he expresses them, and then he expects the rest of the government to act on them. And very often, there are problems with this only because those notions are not very clear. So it's not clear exactly what it is he wants to do in Afghanistan or in Iraq or Syria. But the other problem, of course, is that the United States foreign policy bureaucracy is understaffed. There is not a single assistant secretary or undersecretary who has been appointed, much less confirmed in at the State Department. And those are the folks who usually carry on the difficult task of diplomacy and articulating policy. Similarly, the Department of Defense has General Mattis as his Secretary of Defense. But again, the ranks are rather thin. There's only, I think, two other people who have been confirmed in the Department of Defense. So you have essentially a problem there. As a result, what you see is, at least in the management of the wars, that the White House has given much power to the military commanders on the field to decide what to do. So in terms of how to conduct the fight against ISIS, etc., all these things are decided on the field. Now, it is essentially in great contrast to the Obama White House, which concentrated everything. I mean, Obama was interested in every minutiae of policy, and especially when it came to, let's say, military strikes, the White House had to approve them in advance. But now under Trump, none of that is happening, which of course is a little bit paradoxical, because if you remember that during the campaign, Mr. Trump had said that he knew more about war than all the generals combined, and yet he has, to a large extent, abdicated many of the military decisions to the military. And it is problematic. I mean, even people who are very sympathetic to the military are a little bit worried about the lack of civilian control over the military institution, because, look, generals, officers, as good as they are, as effective as they are, tend to make mistakes, because they're not political animals, and they sometimes do take actions that have severe political consequences that they may not have calculated. So you're asking a lot from the military at this stage, and a little more civilian control is actually necessary at this stage. Certainly not as much as Obama had over the military, which was a little bit too much. But so in that sense, yes, there's a vacuum in terms of military decisions, but on a civilian side, but also in terms of foreign policy in general, the State Department is not up to its full capacity, or minimum capacity even, to conduct diplomacy. Now, specifically in terms of Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, if there is a policy, the policy is to defeat ISIS. And it starts there and it stops there. And if there is any addition that we can make to that policy, is that I think Mr. Trump wants this to be done as soon as possible, which is why you've seen a quick expansion in military activities in Mosul and in Raqqa in Syria. Mr. Trump, I think, wants to capture Raqqa from the Islamic State, and I think it's going to be a moment of pride for him. He's going to argue that Mr. Obama couldn't do it, that he did it. But beyond that, we do not detect, I mean, anybody in Washington, if you ask them, they will say, if you ask them what's happening the day after Raqqa falls and the Islamic State is not necessarily defeated, but at least has been forced to give up its capital, nobody seems to have any idea of what's going to happen next. And that is because the administration has not articulated a post Raqqa policy. Now, in fairness to this administration, we have to say that the its predecessor, the Obama administration, also had no idea of what it was going to do if Raqqa had fallen. But it had not started the Raqqa operation by the time it had transferred power over to Mr. Trump. So, in a way, you can say that they didn't have to. They knew they're not going to have to do it. But clearly, we have no idea what the day after is going to look like.
But surely, Ari Baki, there will be a vacuum. And who will fill the vacuum? We've had conversations over the years as this Syrian agony has gone on. And it's always been clear that the Iranians, the Assad regime, and the Russians know exactly what they're doing. And we have not really ever been clear about what we're doing. We've always known what we don't want, but we don't know what we do want. And surely there's an collision about to happen, isn't it? If we're, on the one hand, we're going to try and fill the vacuum with Sunni militias after ISIS has rolled up, local militias, to hold that territory and so that Assad and the Iranians don't get it. But at the same time, we have, as Mosul falls, we're working with Shia militias over there. So how can you work with different militias in different countries and not end up with some kind of conflict?
Well, I mean, there's this one significant difference between Syria and Iraq, and that is that in Iraq you have a government and a government with which the United States works. So when you talk about those Shia militias with which the United States is working in with respect to Mosul, those are ultimately under, both theoretically and practically, are supposed to be under the control of the central government in Baghdad. So it is not up to the United States to decide who goes up to fight in Mosul, because if the central government decides to send those militias, those are the ones with whom the United States will work. Syria is different. In Syria, clearly the United States is creating new forces or strengthening new forces that have emerged. I mean, more importantly than the Sunni militias are the Kurds. The Kurds have emerged as the most powerful fighting force in Syria, and they certainly, while cooperating with the United States, have also expressed their own preferences and intentions in terms of the future of Syria. They want some kind of, not necessarily autonomy, they want some kind of decentralization and a reduction in the power of the central government, and Damascus in particular, over their territory, so they can essentially, you know, rule themselves. Now, will this militia, which this Kurdish militia, which is seen as a terrorist one by the Turks, survive an American withdrawal once ISIS is gone? Which raises the question that is the United States going to withdraw and allow the Turks to intervene against the Kurds, maybe the Syrian army and its Iranian allies intervening against the Kurds. So, I mean, it's going to be a terrific mess, and we don't know. I mean, logic says that the United States has about 600 advisors now in northern Syria for the Raqqa operation. I mean, logic probably dictates that these people will be withdrawn very, very slowly, if at all, in order to convince everybody not to start divvying up the territories to their own benefit, kind of freeze the conflict where it is now. But that's not a long-term solution, and we don't know what the long-term solution is. I mean, we see that some people are thinking about negotiating with Assad. For some, especially the Syrian opposition, negotiating with Assad is completely unacceptable. I mean, they will talk to Assad, but they will not accept an Assad regime in the long run. They will accept maybe Assad for a short transition period, but they want Assad and his family and his cronies out of Syria. So, but Assad, the Iranians, and the Russians are not about to accommodate this wish. So this is going to go on. I mean, it doesn't look like it's going to end anytime soon.
But does the Assad regime, the Russians and particularly the Iranians, do they want a land corridor from Assad's territory through Iraq into Iran? And isn't there a valuable oil field that will be in this vacuum that's going to be created as ISIS is rolled up?
Well, I mean, there are some oil fields in the, I think, the Rizur, which is still in the control of ISIS, and we need to see what will happen to that town. Now, when it comes to this discussion of a land corridor, people talk about the land corridor stretching from all the way from Iran, through Iraq, through Syria, into Lebanon, Hezbollah territory, so you have the Iranians being able to supply their clients all through Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon at will. I think the importance of the land corridor is probably more psychological than material. That is to say, having a land corridor kind of is an affront to the United States and to its allies and to the Saudis and everybody else who doesn't like Iran. But on the other hand, there is limited utility to a land corridor, because a land corridor means you're going to move stuff on trucks, which can easily be intercepted, can easily be put out of commission. And you can make, if you want to, make the Iranians pay a very, very heavy price for the use of that land corridor. You can mine it, you can bomb it, you can do all kinds of things. And in fact, the Iranians have never needed really a land corridor. When they supply the Hezbollah, they just fly Iran airplanes to Beirut airport, and stuff gets offloaded. It's faster. You don't have to worry about people stopping you. And the Israelis have taken out the munitions and the equipment that the Iranians have brought Hezbollah, but that's once they're away from, you know, on the way to being distributed from, say, Damascus airport to Lebanon. The Israelis have bombed them. So if they do it, you know, I can imagine that they would do it much more regularly if you had this land corridor. I think we're making too much out of the land corridor. I think land corridor is psychologically important, I agree, but militarily, I'm not sure it's as big a deal as people seem to think.
But just to sum up, though, Henri Barki, you're predicting that things are definitely going to get more complicated. And with the Russians now saying that they'll paint and treat as targets any coalition aircraft that goes west of the Euphrates.
Yeah, but I think we, again, that also is an exaggeration.
Right.
The truth is they've been talking to each other, the Americans and the Russians, and the Australians, who had stopped bombing, now are back into bombing guns.
Sure.
And the Russians are not about to start World War III over somebody like Assad. So, you know, they had to say something. They did it. And there's no question that there is a higher risk today of a military confrontation between the United States and Iran, or the United States and Syria, because we shot down two Iranian drones that came close to American troops, and we shot down a Syrian fighter bomber, which also was going to bomb American allies. So these are fairly significant military moves that the United States has undertaken, both as a message and as also as deterrence. But what happens next time if two aircraft approach and they fire missiles, or they shoot down an American airplane, that, you know, we're going into uncharted territories.
Well, Henri Barki, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And I've been speaking with Henri Barki, the director of the Middle East Program for the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller and Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break and be back with a CIA insider talking about Trump's war with the intelligence community. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Melvin Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. During his 42-year government career, he served in official positions at the CIA, the Army, State Department, and the Department of Defense, and is the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism, and his new book just out is Whistleblower at the CIA, An Insider's Account of the Politics of Intelligence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melvin Goodman.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And Mel, your new book, of course, is very much about your personal experience in the CIA, which we certainly will get into. But when you talk about how inside the inner workings of the American intelligence community that you're familiar with, how much corruption, intimidation, and misinformation can lead to disastrous foreign interventions, what we have now is an absentee president, a commander-in-chief who's AWOL, delegated everything to the military, a very explosive situation in Syria and a deteriorating situation in Afghanistan. And now we're just learning that the CIA itself was incredibly nervous about giving information to Trump's first National Security Advisor, General Flynn, because they thought he was compromised and could be blackmailed by the Russians, yet he was getting the most sensitive intelligence available for as long as his tenure lasted there, of course. And we don't know whether Pompeo, the director, had a hand in allowing this to happen or what really happened there. But I guess my first question to you is, in spite of the experiences that you went through, which were pretty grim, it seems that now it's so much worse. I can't believe that some of this stuff that's happening now has to be pretty unprecedented.
Oh, I agree. I think this is the worst situation we've ever had between a president and not only the CIA, but a president and the entire intelligence community. You have to remember that this is a man, in terms of Donald Trump, who's essentially opposed to intelligence of all kinds, whether it's scientific intelligence and climate control or medical intelligence and what we need to do in the field of science generally, or political intelligence and the Central Intelligence Agency. He made it clear that he didn't want any investigations. That's why I think he's tried to intimidate the media. The media is the enemy of the people, or intimidate the CIA, comparing the CIA to Nazi Germany in the 1930s. Then you have a worse situation in terms of the mediocrity of the cabinet that he's chosen, that he's put general officers into positions that should be held by civilians. He's deferred totally to the Pentagon, a general as a Secretary of Defense, a general as a National Security Advisor, a general as the head of the Department of Homeland Security, and even Pompeo is a West Point graduate who served in the military, who I think obfuscated in terms of the Senate investigation when he wouldn't give a yes or no answer to whether or not he had been warned about the security problem and the compromise of General Flynn. Now, it defies imagination that the CIA bureaucracy did not inform Pompeo of this problem. I mean, the first thing a bureaucrat does in terms of an operation like this is to cover his ass. And the best way to do that is to warn Pompeo about the briefing he was heading into with the National Security Advisor. And remember, there was a three-week period between the time Pompeo was named as CIA director and Flynn was fired as the National Security Advisor. And then when you look at the lack of foreign policy, the lack of, I won't say strategic thinking, because there's nothing strategic about the Trump administration, but the lack of thinking on foreign policy and how we've gone back and forth on key issues involving China, involving Taiwan, and involving the One China policy or NATO in Article 5. And then you look at Trump sharing sensitive intelligence with the Russians, intelligence that came from Israeli liaison. So this is a bizarre situation, and at some point, if there is a crisis, Trump is going to have to turn to the intelligence community to justify actions he wants to take. And by putting all of these military people into key positions, he's built up a center of gravity that's really all about worst-case analysis. And remember, the CIA was created in 1947 by Harry Truman to counter worst-case analysis so that the president didn't have to rely on intelligence from the Pentagon. So I don't think we've ever had a situation like this. We've never had a president like this. We've never had a mediocre cabinet like this. And here I totally disagree with the mainstream media and the pundits who feel that these are very moderate people. Well, maybe they're moderate in terms of the mediocre domestic cabinet he has, But I don't find putting general officers in these key positions a sign of moderation at all.
And again, I'm speaking with Melvin Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of a number of books on intelligence, including Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. And his new book just out is Whistleblower at the CIA, An Insider's Account of the Politics of Intelligence. So if Putin's motive was to weaken the United States, and he first wanted to weaken Hillary Clinton, who he assumed would get elected, but he wanted to sort of dirty her up as much as he could, but then it seems like he got an unexpected boost by Trump getting elected, because if weakening America is Putin's motive, nobody has weakened America more than Donald Trump, and nobody will end up weakening America more than Donald Trump. And
well, it's a clear case of be careful what you ask for, because Putin clearly wanted a Trump victory, but now he's inherited a very weakened Donald Trump. In fact, you've got this bizarre situation to me of a very weak president, a very weak leader sitting on a strong country, really, in the United States, and then you have this strong leader, Vladimir Putin, sitting on a very weak country. I mean, Russia has taken these actions in Crimea and eastern Ukraine and Syria, but this doesn't point to Russian strength, in my estimation. I think this conventional wisdom of Russia as more expansionist and more successful really ignores the fact that Putin is facing a lot of political and economic difficulty and had to take actions to boost his popularity. The Crimean action was incredibly popular, and that's why he has popularity ratings in the 75, 80, even 85% level. Syria, I don't think, means that much to the Russian public. I don't think the Russian populace ever really cared about the Middle East. They just didn't want problems emanating from the Middle East. They didn't want Islamic fundamentalism spilling over into their borders or into former Soviet space. But now Putin is in a situation where what he really wanted, which I think was an improved relationship with the United States, which I think, again, is not conventional wisdom, but it's what I believe is the case. I don't see how he's going to get there. And the irony there is there's a lot of, in terms of major fundamental substantive issues, where there's complete agreement with the United States and Russia on arms control, disarmament, counter-proliferation, non-proliferation, controlling Iran's nuclear weapons, controlling North Korea's nuclear program. There's a lot these two sides could do. And even on Syria, frankly, I think Putin is gone as far as he wants to on behalf of Assad. He pulled his fat out of the fire over a year ago, and now I think he would like to use this in terms of leverage in giving Russia more credibility at the bargaining table for however the Syrian situation is resolved, if it ever can be resolved, because now you have the prospect of possible dogfights between fighter aircraft of the United States and Russia over Syrian airspace. It's becoming surreal.
And we don't have a leader. I mean, we literally a man who can't deal with reality and who doesn't seem to want to lead the country as a commander-in-chief. I don't think you could have a more explosive situation.
I don't think he knows how to lead. In fact, it's interesting to me that when CIA Director Pompeo was talking about briefings for Donald Trump, he was trying to create the image of a Donald Trump who is really interested in these intelligence briefings in the morning. And he referred to the fact we provide these killer graphics for him. Well, I guess what he gets is all in crayon. You know, these must be briefings that are very, very short in nature and not very substantive. And then for him to get a piece of sensitive intelligence and share it with the Russians shows he has no real understanding of the material that he is seeing. And he has never shown any propensity for really doing a deep dive into any of these issues, whether they're domestic or international.
So let's turn to your book, your new book just out, Mel Goodman, Whistleblower at the CIA, An Insider's Account of the Politics of Intelligence. It's a little paradoxical because at the moment many people are counting on the intelligence community to expose what Trump has been up to, and particularly with the Russians, and possibly even lead to his impeachment. But when you talk about corruption and misinformation and intimidation, in your experience, what's the mechanism by which the intelligence community is corrupt? Is it corrupting the presidency?
When I talk about corruption, I'm talking about corruption of intelligence, and I'm talking about two important periods of politicization. in my experience. One was in the 1980s when President Reagan wanted an unprecedented peacetime increase in defense spending, and you had to create a Soviet threat that was 10 feet tall. That's when CIA Director Bill Casey and Deputy Bob Gates collaborated in a conspiratorial way to create disinformation about the Soviet Union, making the Soviet Union look more powerful than it really was in a decade when the Soviet Union was showing every sign of incredible weakness. And then, of course, in 1991, you had incredible dissolution, which was totally unanticipated. And then you fast forward another 10 years or so, and you have the run-up to the Iraq War when President Bush says to CIA Director George Tenet, I need intelligence to go to the American people to convince them of the need for war. And it was George Tenet who jumped up from his chair and said, that would be a slam dunk, Mr. President. And he had a deputy, John McLaughlin, who actually delivered a slam dunk briefing. And it wasn't to convince George Bush. He was going to war regardless of what the CIA had to say. It was to take to the American people, to fool the American people, just as Secretary of State Colin Powell in February, only 6 weeks before the war started, took the same phony intelligence from that slam dunk briefing and from the phony national intelligence estimate of October 2002 and delivered that to an international audience. So you had a white paper done by Paul Pillar that was designed to fool the Congress. You had intelligence, international intelligence designed to fool the United Nations that was delivered by Colin Powell, and you had general disinformation that the CIA and the Pentagon, the Office of Special Plans, circulated to fool the American people. And I think the great tragedy in all of this is, you know, how many young men and women died in Iraq and Afghanistan thinking they were avenging Saddam Hussein's linkage to 9/11 or Saddam Hussein's linkage to Osama bin Laden or Saddam Hussein's linkage to Al-Qaeda, all of which did not take place. You know, were they going to serve because of phony intelligence? That's why I think this great tragic period, which really turned on the worst decision any president ever made, the decision to invade Iraq, and we're still paying for it. If you look at the Middle East and the apocalyptic condition of the Middle East, it all started with the March 2003 invasion of Iraq.
Well, Mel Goodman, I know we've run out of time here, but I'd like to continue the conversation later, and I am grateful for you joining us here today.
Thank you. I look forward to that, Ian.
And again, I'm speaking with Melvin Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. He's the author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. And his new book just out is Whistleblower at the CIA, An Insider's Account of the Politics of Intelligence. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.